When the lawyers are ready, we're happy to hear argument in our third case, United States versus Brandt. Please be seated. Dennis' chair. It's your chair that's making a squeaky noise.
Yes, mine.
So would you be very quiet?
Is that you hearing that?
My friend is.
Good. Keep going.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Nicholas Zanakis for Bryston Grant. This Court should follow almost every other circuit in the country and adopt the common law doctrine of credit for time at liberty. And it should follow the majority rule of those circuits in adopting a rule that awards credit when the government acted negligently. Our position is that test is best proposed by the Third Circuit in Vega versus United States.
Well, that is the standard that's used by every other circuit. Third Circuit went out on a hoot of its own.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the Third Circuit explains how it integrates a lot of what the other courts have done in terms of determining whether to
what
award.
What other circuit do you think adopts the Third Circuit?
I apologize. To clarify, I don't believe anybody after Vega has specifically adopted the Vega test. I do, however, believe that the Vega test follows previous precedent, whether that be from White or Swope.
Previous precedent within the circuit?
Within other circuits.
Adopting a bit here and a bit there.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the whole that the Third Circuit came up with is new creation, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We do, however, believe that other circuits do award credit.
How much time are we talking about?
10 days, Your Honor.
Does any other case involve that kind of time?
No, Your Honor. The majority of cases where this arises involves much more significant periods of time. But I would point the Court to the Ninth Circuit's decision in Martinez, which does mention, if I could quote briefly from that, that it's immaterial whether the convicted person has served one day or 10 years of his sentence. If he is erroneously released thereafter, he's entitled to full day-for-day credit for the time that he was at liberty. And I believe that's consistent.
Why wouldn't any formulation, and maybe you'll say some do, take into account the clean hands of the defendant and any efforts he made to get the mistake corrected?
Your Honor, I think the courts have pointed out for two things. The one would be, I believe the Arizona Supreme Court in Schwichtenberg discussed how it would be unreasonable to expect defendants to understand the circumstances of their erroneous release.
No, it wouldn't be at all. Somebody got a 15-day sentence and it's day three. It wouldn't be to say, what the heck? I'm getting ready to go. I get to go home today?
Well, Your Honor.
That's not hard. That's not hard to figure.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, in terms of calculation for good time credit, and just to give an example.
Well, it depends. It would be, in some circumstances, maybe in a 15-day sentence, how much good time is calculated on a 15-day sentence?
There was no good time credit on the 15-day sentence.
Right.
But other circumstances, however, would arise
to
give that
you
problem.
Had 10 or 20 years. That's why I was asking you.
That's correct. But additionally, along with that rationale,
I will bet you most prisoners have a pretty doggone good idea when they're getting released, since we don't have parole anymore. Certainly, in federal crimes, they have a good idea. 85% of what they're charged over a day, I mean over a year, they know it.
Well, Your Honor, I would. Once again, respectfully disagree in terms of speaking to clients of mine trying to estimate their times of release.
Maybe the lawyer didn't calculate 85% of. You get the calculation in federal court, you get that calculation at the time you go to prison, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but that calculation changes once you arrive at prison based on a couple factors.
Depends on whether or not you lose good time.
Or whether you participate in programs such as RDAP,
right.
Whether there is a subsequent sentence reduction based on such as amendments to the sentencing guidelines. So I think there is quite a few factors that could play.
Yeah, but I tell you, no need to argue this too much. I guarantee most prisoners have a pretty good idea of when they're getting out of jail.
Well, Your Honor, I think
at least all the hundreds that I've dealt with have a pretty good idea.
Well, Your Honor, maybe my second point might go to this as well, which I think, once again, the Ninth Circuit in that same Martinez case discusses how it would be somewhat in opposite to essentially place the burden on the defendant to take himself to trial in that way.
Can I just, before you move away from what I thought Judge Schitt's question was going to be, when the question began with the discussion of clean hands, The thing that I noticed about the district court's proposed five-factor test, in addition to just having a personal inherent aversion to five-factor tests, was the fact that none of these five factors takes any note, considers the equities involved. It's the nature of the underlying offense, the length of the sentence, the character of the government error, the length of the erroneous period, and how quickly the government tried to reacquire, and the degree to which the prisoner has resettled. None of it, there's no catch-all equitable consideration of, this guy kept trying to turn himself back in, doggone it, and they wouldn't let him. So it does seem to me as though there should be some ability for the district court to say, this guy really did try to come back and tell you that he was inappropriately incarcerated.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. We believe that Mr. Grant took all the necessary steps, not only contacting counsel.
Well, why? But that was my question, too, before we got in our discussion. Exactly that. Why wouldn't you take that in any common law rule that we would adopt? Why wouldn't that be a factor you would take into account? I call it clean hands. Just Duncan talked about equity. It's just the same concept. That you'd look at it, but first, it seems to me it's entirely different situations. If one person, they say, it's clear the person knows he's not supposed to leave for another year, and they release him. Well, and he says nothing. Or if somebody goes, I think you got the wrong guy. Gosh, I wish it were me, but I think you got the wrong guy. And they look at this and go, no, you listen to us. You're getting out of here today. You sure about that? Seems to me that helps the second situation.
Well, Your Honor,
for claiming time.
Your Honor, we obviously believe that would help Mr. Grant's case. But in this court adopting a rule that would be applicable to cases beyond Mr. Grant's, I would return to my initial point, which is that there are confusing situations. And I think that, especially if you're talking about consecutive and concurrent time with different sovereigns and things of that nature, it can be quite confusing. And I think in those circumstances, it's difficult to tell exactly what steps a defendant or prisoner should have
taken.
But
that's something that the district court could take into consideration in the appropriate circumstance. It may not be a factor on certain facts, and it may be a factor in other situations. If you're going to have these factors, or if you're going to have factors, then it would seem to me need to be some room for the district court to assess, make individualized assessments that include a reflection of the characteristics of the defendant as well as the nature of the government's error. That was my only point.
Well,
it was a question, sort of.
On that point, I thought that the district court, if I'm reading it, less than a week after defendant's release, the probation official took prompt steps to remedy the mistake. I thought that it was your position that was clearly erroneous factual finding, that in fact your client initiated the government's understanding that a mistake had been made.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
Where do we I find that, you say that a lot, what record support is for that?
Your Honor, the only record support would be the assertions we made in the motion to the district court. To the magistrate judge, that were reasserted before the district court. Evidence was never taken on it because the government never disputed that fact. But there was no hearing to determine what exactly had occurred.
So the district judge either ignored that fact, or this finding, this discussion that he says, less than a week after defendant's release, the probation official took prompt steps, is erroneous.
That's correct, Your Honor. Our stance would be erroneous. They had not been made aware of it until counsel contacted the probation office after Mr. Grant contacted me.
And you make another claim, I think, that the district court's suggestion that this was not his first violation of supervised release is incorrect.
That's correct as well, Your Honor. Mr. Grant's violation, we only had one violation to give the court the background on the case. Mr. Grant's original conviction was for a possession offense. Following that, he was charged with state offenses, which formed the basis for a violation of probation. That was the only violation of probation until this circumstance is here, where after Mr. Grant was released, the probation officer, as a mechanism to get Mr. Grant back into court.
That he violated probation, whereas actually they'd released him.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so there's two arguably errors, factual errors in the district court's conclusions. On the other hand, this is a really small sentence. He is allowed to work, and he only is serving this on the weekends. So what do we do with all that? Do we have to send it back to the district court? If we conclude that even with the factual findings being correct, that this was no abuse of discretion in rejecting your argument, what do we do?
Well, Your Honor, if this court does adopt the five-factor test, which I would point out
which five-factor test?
The district court's five-factor test.
Yeah. We're adopting our own test, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we recognize the legitimacy in the various factors that the district court talked about, but we adopt whatever test we have one of our own. What do we do with these findings of fact that are erroneous?
Your Honor, I think you would still remand to the district court. Note that those factors were erroneous and allow us...
We conclude that on the basis of the other evidence that the district court would have not abused its discretion in refusing to adopt your position?
Your Honor, I think at that point a remand would still be appropriate because at the time of the hearing, we did not know what evidence to necessarily present. We presented this evidence to provide context to the case, but we were not given the opportunity to go through each of these five factors.
Well,
and supplement
you don't have any other evidence that is lurking somewhere?
Your Honor, I think that part of it obviously would be such as more personal characteristics of Mr. Grant going
through the settlement. You don't get a do-over just because you could have done a better job the first time. The question is, if there's evidence in the record, if there's sufficient evidence in the record for us to decide on the basis of what there is, stripping out what the district court arguably got wrong, why it would just be and found that the district court did not abuse its discretion, we could still affirm, could we not?
No, Your Honor, I don't think you could affirm, partially because of what exactly happened mechanically with the sentence. And I think
what happened, what specifically are you talking about other than the fact of it being reimposed?
As we discussed, I believe in the reply brief, 18 U.S.C. 3585A. Which requires that, if I could read that briefly as well, a sentence to a term of imprisonment commences on the date the defendant is received in custody, awaiting transportation to or arise voluntarily to commence service at a sentence, the official detention facility at which the sentence is to be served. And so therefore, even in imposing, adopting this test, the district court and the magistrate judge still legally, erroneously modified the sentence without the authority to do so.
Let me ask this.
I'm sorry. I just don't understand that answer. But Judge Shedd has a question coming. Is he going to help me understand that answer?
No, but we can tackle this one if you want to go ahead and ask that.
Okay. Sure. So I don't understand what your point is.
3585A says that a sentence begins once it immediately commences. Oh. And so, therefore, having Mr. Grant go back to serve these additional days after his sentence would have terminated under 3585A is an illegal modification of the sentence.
Because the 15 days count period would take him beyond.
Yes, sir.
But isn't that subsumed in the larger inquiry of whether he gets credit?
Your Honor, I believe it's...
Isn't it always going to be... Well, not always, but at least... Well, maybe not always, but isn't that just a re-argument of your basic legal argument about credit for the time that he was missing and the government was negligent?
No, Your Honor, we believe that it's one way in which the statutory structure reflects the doctrine.
Oh, well, then it's, yeah. I mean, okay, so let me just say this, or ask, if we remanded, what additional evidence would be brought forth?
Believe that we would have additional evidence of resettlement, affidavits, possibly from Mr. Grant and his family, what he has done with his work relationship.
Well, but he maintains his work relationships. He only serves these days on the weekends. There was a he received a considerable accommodation.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that.
Excuse me? I mean, the district court allowed him to continue his employment and serve his sentence in a way that didn't interrupt his new job?
Your Honor.
You don't think that's an accommodation?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. I would offer this. If I realize my time is up, if I might answer.
No, and you have, Judge Schitt has a question. So go ahead. Go ahead and answer this question first.
One of the reasons clients specifically ask oftentimes to serve their sentence straight is because that allows them to be terminated afterwards and can put these situations behind them. Remaining on incarceration, remaining on probation during that time while someone intermittently serves their sentence could in fact be an additional burden.
Wait. But that's on the belief that he didn't have to serve any time.
Right. That's just because you don't like the
result. No, you're subsuming that the error in that response because, listen, if he wanted to... So you're saying this, if he has to serve any additional time, he wants to serve it consecutive days starting on a Monday?
Well, Your Honor, that was Mr. Grant's original position. I cannot make that representation today.
Really? Because he works on weekends? Is that what, I mean, I don't really understand that.
I believe my client's position was that he wanted to have this resolved, the entire matter resolved in federal court completely as soon as possible and serving time intermittently.
Why did he ask him to go? Did he say, Your Honor, you should put me back in jail right now?
Well, Your Honor, because at the time we were arguing about whether he deserved credit, but I would point out to the court that...
Well, that's just the point that we made to you.
Your Honor, I would also add to the court that at the district court appeal, Mr. Grant did ask to be stepped back for the day to have that one day that would have been in dispute still resolved.
I've had defendants when I was a district court judge. I tried to set up something for them. And on occasion, they would go, Your Honor, be kind of mad. And I go, I thought I helped you. No, sir, I want to go to jail immediately. I said, I can grant that for you. And some people would say, look, I want to do it right now. Actually, it's a supervised release violation. And he says, don't continue me. I'm sick of the government looking on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. Give me a hard time, and then I'm through with all of you.
Mm-hmm.
I accommodated him. Mm-hmm.
And that's what your client said to the district court?
No.
I want to go right now. Yeah. If I'm going to go, I want to go now.
That was not the district court. I believe that was at the original violation hearing. To ask for the 15 days of termination, 15 days and then termination.
Right.
That's what we sought at the original violation.
Let me ask this. Judge Motz read this to you. Less than a week after the defendant's release, U.S. Probation Officer Wilson took prompt steps to remedy the mistake. And you said that's clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is that clearly erroneous? She didn't, or whoever that was, he or she, didn't take prompt steps to remedy it?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Grant contacted me. I contacted the probation office earlier in that week.
She took prompt steps. It's not as clean as you would.
I'm just saying. Is it? In other words, is it true? Then you still may have an argument about other things, but I don't see how, unless you tell me otherwise, that's clearly erroneous.
I would add to the context for that statement is that normally the probation office nor BOP becomes aware of these sort of situations until much after release, when they're essentially closing out records. And so,
you just want to. I think that's not clearly erroneous. What you want to say is an inference you might read from that doesn't really reflect the fact that my client really is the one that instituted the correction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Make that clearly erroneous.
Well, I would offer that the way that the district court interpreted that as a factor against Mr. Gratt made it clearly erroneous.
Where did he do that?
I believe in the district court opinion.
I don't know, but you say in there he went, since he didn't report, he gets dinged for that?
The district court did not at any point credit Mr. Grant for his proactive steps in reporting his release.
It's an omission rather than a commission.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions at this time, I'd ask to reserve my remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you. So does the government concede that this credit doctrine exists?
Does it exist as a common law doctrine? The answer would not concede that. Does it exist as something where if there's something beyond negligence, government are acting arbitrarily, government acting in contravention to law. I think in those circumstances, the government concede that if someone is deliberate, if the U.S. Marshals, for example, take steps to deliberately release someone and then recollect them and then release them.
Sort of the Seventh Circuit view.
That's right.
That's as far as the government. But the government concedes there is such a doctrine recognized in federal courts.
That's correct.
To that extent.
And then we would say that it starts and ends with gross negligence at the least, or some sort of affirmative government.
Of course, we don't have to hold that in this case to win, do we?
That's correct. I mean, the government's position here is that the district court did not abuse its discretion. It assumed that there was a common law rule for credit at time at liberty, applied what Vega called the three paramount interests that should underlie such a rule, which is defendant's interest in resettlement, the need to avoid this kind of arbitrary action, and, of course, government and society's interest in having prisoners serve out their full sentences, and then constructed an analysis, a non-exhaustive set of analysis of factors that allowed it to give life to those three paramount interests, and the court did not abuse its discretion in doing
so. Does the government dispute the fact that the defendant initiated the government's actions in reincarcerating him?
We do not dispute that at all. We do dispute the idea that the district court clearly erred in assessing that fact. What I believe the district court was getting at, and again, starting from the premise that the issue here is government arbitrary conduct, and the cases where the courts have found government arbitrary conduct or suggested that there might be arbitrary conduct is when the government or the marshals are put on notice that there's someone who has a detainer pending, for example, and the marshals do nothing or repeatedly do nothing. Now, I wouldn't concede that in this case necessarily had the probation officer been put on notice if there were what the delay would be where that would rise to arbitrariness. But I believe what Judge Ellis was getting at was as soon as the probation officer was aware, she took steps to bring the defendant back in.
Is there any record evidence about that? We seem to have counsel's arguments about most of this.
I believe that's in opposing counsel's brief, that in terms of the timeline, let's see. He was mistakenly released from custody on.
Where are you reading?
Oh, my notes. I'm sorry. I'll give you the joint appendix sites. He was mistakenly released from custody on the 19th. That, of course, is not.
What's the JA site?
So the 26, JA 26, is the docket that indicates that the probation officer filed a petition on probation on February 25th, 6 days later. I believe that the date that the probation officer was informed was February 24th. So the next day after the probation officer was informed, a petition on probation was filed. And if I'm incorrect on that, if it was not the next day, it was short. It was in a period of days. This was
okay.
Not a so time I when the probation officer was sitting.
So I look at JA 26, and I see the record, the 37. Is that what you're talking about? All it has is petition and order on probation, ordering that a warrant be issued.
Now let me get.
I see JA 51. This is not. It's the defendant's motion for credit, and it says, early the next week, defense counsel contacted the probation office to explain the situation and discuss how best to proceed. That Friday, the probation office filed a petition, so it would be. Sounds like a couple of days.
That's correct, right? And that's the opening brief, page 4.
Okay.
That's better than
what early next week means. But they assert that on Friday the petition was filed, so early next week was Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever. It's a few days.
I'm not sure that the record makes clear what exactly the date is, but in terms of.
And it does refer to Docket 37, which was reading. Yeah.
And I believe that's what the district court was saying, that he was not denying.
You think he just put that in for purpose of showing that the government didn't lag. When they found out, they acted quickly.
That's correct. And certainly there was evidence before the district court, and I believe there's no indication that the district court did not consider that Mr. Grant did bring this to the attention of the judge.
Anywhere in any of this, I'm not saying there is, I'm just asking, some idea that a jailkeeper can't, somehow the government can't be a stop because of that. If you go through normal procedure in the court and a judge imposes a legal sentence, seems odd that that sentence somehow is a claim it can't be carried out because the government is stopped. I mean, is not a stop. I mean, rather is a stop because of a bureaucratic error.
I don't.
Is that gathered anywhere?
In terms of gathered,
in any kind of formula anybody applies, or even applying a formula.
Some of the circuits go there.
I mean, certainly Vega, which we disagree with, goes there, and I believe the Ninth Circuit goes there. But our interpretation of every other circuit,
it says you can't have any kind of good time credit.
Oh, I'm sorry. That negligence is enough.
No, I'm saying that. I'm saying, how does the government get stopped from giving the full sentence that has been regularly, legally imposed because of some mistake by somebody down the line? It's not the exact fit, but I do know anything that fits, at least it certainly used to be the law, but as to the federal FISC, you cannot have an agent or person, a bureaucrat, I don't mean that pejoratively, a person maybe explaining the program to somebody and going, yes, you can get funds for X. Yes, you can. And that second child is entitled to more money. And so the family goes out in anticipation and buys some extra clothes and some extra food. If the federal program doesn't authorize it, what the agent says just doesn't matter.
And that's
what I was kind of talking about. I know we're talking about good time credit, but it seems to me there's at least some consideration for how does a valid sentence handed down after a criminal procedure by a court subject to appeal and everything somebody wants to do is a valid sentence, how does that somehow get reduced or removed? Because, like I say, a jailkeeper puts the key in the wrong cell door.
And that's why the government urges the court to tread carefully before invoking common law here, and I believe that's what Judge Posner and Judge Lynch were getting at in Dunn from the Seventh Circuit and Espinoza from the First Circuit, and that Congress has spoken clearly on certain areas in terms of, for example, good time credit under 18 U.S.C. 3585.
To reduce the sentence.
That's right. Or under 3584, Congress has spoken about how multiple terms of imprisonment should be calculated when they're imposed, for example, at the same time. They're presumed to be concurrent if they're presumed.
So the government's position here, there should be no doctrine of common law at all.
That is... our position, and at least...
No, in response to my first question, you acknowledged that there was a common law doctrine, but that you had to it was based on the finding that the government had been intentional.
And I should clarify, I don't necessarily know that that would be a common law doctrine.
I see.
I think if there was, at some point, and without committing the government in a future case, at some point...
go ahead and commit.
If a U.S. Marshal is arbitrarily releasing someone and collecting them and releasing them and collecting them, I think this court's opinion in Hawkins would suggest that that would at some point arise to a due process violation.
Right.
So I would say I don't think that the court needs to conclude that there's a common law doctrine if the court...
Or conclude that there isn't.
But if the court...
But you're just making the claim there could be a way for somebody to get relief based on government conduct outside common law. It could be due process or something.
That's exactly right. In a case where you have truly egregious action, those...
So then what would you have us do here? Just say nothing about it, just say no abuse of discretion?
I'd say that, at least for purposes of this case, the parties agree that we can assume, at least the government is willing to assume the existence of a common law doctrine and affirm on the basis of no abuse of discretion. It would be the same result as if the court were to hold that there were none. Of course, we'd like the stronger position if we could and say that there
is. Your point is, because your point would be then, he's going to serve the full amount of time he should serve, was scheduled to serve anyway.
That's correct.
How do you feel about the district court's test?
I think that it, in connection, in as in similar cases as in Norrie, which is the Southern District of New York case. It collects the most important factors that go to those paramount interests. Although I take your point, Judge Duncan, that it did not explicitly get to the equities of actions taken by the defendant that should count. I would say it didn't do so explicitly. I think factor three, which pointed out the timing of when the probation officer was notified and then how quickly the probation officer took action. As I said before, I think what the district court was getting at mostly there was the probation officer didn't dilly-dally. But I think that certainly the facts were before the district court, and district court was aware that this was a defendant who had brought up who brought this to the probation officer's attention. Though I'd also point out this is not a defendant who brought that up immediately as he was being released. He was released, he reached out to his counsel, so this was not the case where...
Well, how much time elapsed?
I believe it was 5 days or something.
The government acted speedly. He did too,
That's exactly. I'm not trying to make more of it than is there, is all I mean.
Would your position, if you have one, be that we don't have to articulate a test here because the district court did not abuse its discretion on these facts regardless?
I think yes. I mean, to the extent that the court has disagreements with particular factors that the district court relied upon, I think that the court can make those disagreements clear, but that unless the court were to find that the district court would have applied the factors differently or that those factors would have made a difference, I think that the abuse of discretion
standard... Or we could articulate it as. I mean...
That's correct.
Okay. Now, can I ask you about the other contention that they make, which the district court was clearly in error, and that was the business about this was not his first violation of supervised release conditions. That was wrong, right?
Not necessarily. So it's both what it said literally was true and what...
Because of this violation. But he... Okay, accepting this violation, which he brought about himself, right? I mean, he told them about it, and so they used the violation as the procedure to get him back to court. Is there some other violation that's lurking here?
I think what I would say is...
But it sort of goes to the same point of not dealing with the equities.
But I would say, it was literally accurate, but to borrow a phrase, also what the district court meant is clear, and that... perhaps the district court was saying this was the second violation on supervised release, which, though literally accurate, I take the court's point that the second violation wasn't really a violation. But I think what the court, the rest of the court's analysis says, this was a repeat offender, and that was what the district court was emphasizing, and that Mr. Grant had an initial conviction for PCP possession, and then 4 days later he was... found with charged or apprehended in connection with marijuana distribution. So from the district court's point of view, this was a repeat offender. I take the court's point that it would have been better to say that that was not a repeat violation on probation because, although technically correct, that's not really in substance what the court was getting at, but I'm not sure that I would agree that it was a clear error here. And I want to jump back really quick, Judge Motz, to you pointed out when I said, let's remember that Mr. Grant is not the defendant who benefits from the rule of immediately telling the jailer, hey, you're letting me out too early. And you rightly said, well, he brought it up a few days later. What I was trying to get at there inartfully was the other cases, where cases find either a due process violation or something getting close to arbitrary government conduct, it's what Your Honors were asking Mr. Xenakis about earlier, which is a case where a defendant is about to be let out, and he says, no, you got the wrong guy. I wish I could be getting out.
What Shedd was talking about.
That's right. And the court in White, for example, said that the defendant protested and was ejected from the penitentiary. I'm not saying that that would necessarily arise to arbitrariness.
Good luck or bad luck. You make an argument, you lose the argument, but you lost, but you get free.
That's
I don't know what you call that.
I don't know either. But I also agree that there's not a case that the government is aware of where a defendant was released as a result of mere negligence, and that defendant was also confused about his or her release date. So to get to Judge Shedd's point earlier, all the cases that are cited, and as far as the government's aware, there's no case where a defendant was erroneously released and was confused about his or her release date, which gets to the point that defendants are generally not confused about their release dates, except in cases where they protest and are ejected from the penitentiary, as in White.
And the only reason for my question about a catch-all category was in the circumstances where it might be appropriate, just if we were looking at a test.
And I think there are certainly – I think that does inform the test, and I think it would – to the extent that the court does want to adopt a test, we'd urge it not to, but to the extent that it does, I think that could inform the test. And I would just say – to the extent that the court doesn't, that's built into the arbitrariness in a sense.
You think if we adopt a test, maybe this has been answered, if we adopt a test that's different than the test that the court applied below, even by adding the equity factor, do you think we would have to send it back for consideration under that, or we could just look at the record and say there's no evidence of that in this record? Although, as the other side says, what the heck? We didn't know we had to say anything about that.
No, I think the court could make that harmlessness determination, particularly because, as I think I hope I've answered the court's questions about the potential clear errors. I don't believe that the district court committed clear errors of fact. And the fact, for example, that there might be more resettlement evidence now.
What about an equities argument?
I don't think he
would want to say, I'm the one that self-reported.
I think the court is aware of the equity issues that are in the record as there are. If Mr. Xenakis has more to offer you on rebuttal, I'm sure he will. I would only point out about with resettlement, for example, what counts for resettlement isn't his resettlement efforts today.
Right.
It's at the time back in March.
Was there oral argument in this case?
There was, both in front of Judge Buchanan at the magistrate judge and then in front of Judge Ellis, the district court judge.
And so at oral argument, was the district court informed that the defendant had initiated these efforts to come back?
I've said that a couple times, and now I hope that's accurate. I'm quite sure that's accurate. I don't have a JA site off the top of my head, but it was in the record, I believe, or at least represented by defense counsel at the time, and certainly not disputed by the government at any point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So was the district court aware that your client had initiated this?
Yes, Your Honor. We would say that he was, based on my representations in the briefing. I would note for the court that the oral argument mostly focused on the applicability of the Vega test and whether the district court wanted to adopt that test. But we would say yes.
So your position is you've been telling every judge who will listen to you, you just can't give anybody to give you guy credit for having done it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was the district court also informed that there was just one violation of probation?
Your Honor,
parole.
Your Honor, I would say yes, based on the posture of the case. I did not become aware until when the district court used a term violation until the opinion was issued.
Gotcha.
That was not an issue at the oral argument. I would note, as this court looks at the district court's test for abuse of discretion, the point we made about the totality of the circumstances test, that none of it is really dispositive. Even the district court noted that in its own opinion, it was essentially completely in its discretion at the end. And so based on that, we don't think it would be workable in any way. And I think inherently it would qualify as an abuse of discretion based on its own standard. Therefore, that's one reason we believe this court should adopt a more bright-line rule, and we believe that other courts have also followed suit in adopting a more bright-line rule.
Well, but if we adopted, for example, the Seventh Circuit's bright-line rule, then there's no basis for reversal.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that in terms of the facts of the Dunn case. Once again, in Dunn, the defendant was essentially only moved from custody once. Although they're at the same facility, they're moved from federal custody to state custody back to federal custody. which is essentially what's happened here. I would respectfully offer to the court that as the courts discuss this cat and mouse game, we're really only typically dealing with one release. And I think that makes sense based on the amount and the effect that simply being released once and reincarcerated can have on an individual.
Do you have any other questions?
I can't get that poor guy complaining and getting ejected from prison.
That's
astounding to me.
Based on that, Your Honor, we'd ask the court to adopt the vacatest and reverse the district court. Thank you very much, Your Honor.